Wessex LMCs, supporting you and your practice.
Hi, and welcome to another Wessex LMCs podcast. I'm Zoe Tobin, Nurse Advisor at Wessex LMCs, and I'm kindly joined today by Julia O'Mara and Julia Judd, who are both our trainers from J2S, who provide our healthcare assistant training here at Wessex. And today we're discussing the HCA role in primary care. Thank you both for joining me today. Julia O'Mara, would you like to, obviously they're both Julias, so we're going to go surnames. Julia O'Mara, do you want to go first, just give a little introduction and about your background?
Yeah, of course. Good afternoon, Zoe and everybody. Thank you for listening. My name is Julia O'Mara. I've been a nurse now for over 30 years and spent most of my career really in primary care general practice as a practice nurse, nurse practitioner, prescribing and looking after patients with long-term conditions. But I also had a role strategically with the CCG, and my portfolio was workforce, developing the workforce and induction, appraisal, governance. And now I mainly concentrate on education.
Lovely. Thank you, Julia. And Julia Judd.
My name is Julia Judd, and similar to Julia O'Mara, very similar backgrounds, actually. She's done the hard work for me because we followed a very similar trajectory, training back in the mid-80s, and I've worked in primary care for the previous 30 years as well. The only difference being I haven't had that strategic role. I've been working more clinically as a nurse practitioner until I made the decision to retire from clinical practice last year at the grand old age of 56.
Fabulous. That's certainly not a grand old age. So thank you both for joining me today. So we just want to have a little chat really, don't we, about the role of the healthcare assistant in primary care, how that, you know, to really get a nice overview of what they can do, what they can't do in their role, development opportunities, that kind of thing. So really, what do you think is the real benefit that a HCA role brings to the general practice?
It's really interesting because when you look at it through history, I know certainly when Julia and I started in practice, there was no role of a healthcare assistant in the early 90s. There was no way of really introducing it into the surgery because it just didn't fit the mold. And then if you fast forward now, that 30 years, you can see that the HCA role has very quickly become quite synonymous with working in general practice. And in fact, you could argue that it is the similar role to that of the treatment room nurse, because the healthcare assistant is taking on so much more of the burden of general practice work. Certainly all those sort of roles within wound care, data collection, the sort of regular ongoing appointments that come through the door tend to be managed hugely by the HCAs. The difficulty is determining where that sits with the rest of the team. And I think that's where people get a little bit confused and mixed up about the roles and responsibilities of their team, because there is so much grey area and moving across boundaries that we're seeing. And that seems to be accelerating even more now as we're moving forward with, you know, changes that have come into place from the NHS. So it does make it more difficult to sort of not shoehorn an HCA role into practice, but certainly to find that area that sits comfortably for the HCA.
I totally agree. I think HCAs are invaluable in general practice, and I honestly believe general practice could not function without the role of the HCA. They are the backbone of general practice in my view, and we need to really sort of value and grow our HCAs within sort of primary care. But exactly as Julia Judd said, that, you know, we're working with private primary care organisations. Every sort of surgery or PCN will run their organisation slightly differently, and therefore these job descriptions can differ between the organisations. So we try to, with our education, we try to aim our education in supporting HCAs to empower them to know what their role is as well, so that they can drive through that change and build up their portfolio of education and competencies and take that information back to the practice. It is a lot about giving them the information, isn't it, to move forward?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And just expanding on that, Eva, Julia, we talked about their education, and obviously there's different levels of training for the HCA, and the education that you provide will specify, obviously they need to be at a certain level to undertake certain skills. Yeah. Would would you be able to kind of just summarise what that looks like, the sort of levels of HCA training and why those requirements are necessary?
It's really, again, it's changed so much in the last decade. And I think what's driven a lot of that, probably in the last 5 years, is the new ARS roles that are coming forward. So for those of you who may not be familiar with the ARS roles, this is the Additional Roles Reimbursement Scheme, which was introduced by the government back in 2019. Very quiet to start with, but it seems to have hit the floor running now, and we're seeing a plethora of different roles coming forward. And when you look into the details around those ARS roles, there's 17 domains that you can apply for funding towards employment and backfill for your staff within that MDT. And when you look at the sort of levels that would perhaps move across to a healthcare assistant role, you can sort of pull out, I was looking at it in detail and thought that there's at least sort of six different roles that could come under the similar umbrella to an HCA, which is quite difficult to again be able to quantify. So if you look on that list, it starts with things like a health and wellbeing coach, social prescribing, there's care coordinators, the nursing associate role, and within that it encompasses the trainee nursing associate role. And then the GP assistant role, which we're seeing when we're doing our training courses, when we go around in the morning and introduce each of the delegates who are there, we sort of say to them, what's your background, where you come from? And they come with these titles, and you're delivering the same training to that whole plethora of staff. So it can be quite tricky to know really where they're coming from in terms of experience and academic and understanding as well. And I think that's what we have to be very certain of when we're training HCAs.
To try and simplify things, we actually talk about level two and level three, you know, when we're training HCAs. So we would kind of quantify somebody new coming into the post. And we talked about this before, Zoe, haven't we? Somebody who may have been a receptionist or phlebotomist, and, you know, the surgery have identified them as being very capable, having those good interpersonal skills. They want to progress. So where do they sit in that framework? And what is the framework? And we would say that actually they would enter in at a level two. They've just joined general practice, so they need the fundamental sort of care certificate and the area to understand what is a role in caring for patients, really. So getting that dignity and respect and equality and diversity and governance and all the kind of bits that form part of that induction role of a HCA would be level two. And then for Julia Judd and I, when we get them into the training room, we think, well, level two can perform sort of some tasks with training. Every single part of their task requires some training, knowledge and skills and application of skills. But actually, then they can do things like blood pressure taking, the OBS, temperature pulse, RESPs, urinalysis. And really, that would be the level two, wouldn't? Would you agree, Julia? Like removal of stitches, things where they can have that indirect observation once signed off. And then we more or less move up to sort of level three, which we used to years ago when we had the vocational programs, call that the NVQ3. Obviously that's phased out now. We've got health and social care diplomas and apprenticeships, but level three is a HCA, or as Julia says, one of these other roles with some academic knowledge. So they've done something like a diploma. They may not have done a degree, but they've had academic learning via a college, so they have that deeper understanding of things like consent, confidentiality, mental capacity, and areas that they would need if they were then to go on and do more advanced skills such as a vaccination. So I think that's how we quantify it, isn't it, at the moment, Julia? Because you're quite right, but they're all coming with these different titles.
Absolutely. And when you drill down on those titles, the level of training that sits with them is very, it can be easily misinterpreted. So there's lots of stuff that it suggests can be completed online and in-house. And I always worry a little bit about that, because knowing the pressures that there are in practice, I envisage somebody being stuck in the room in front of a computer screen with no sort of interaction with their colleagues within the team, and actually getting that experiential learning that is so important. Because the other sort of caveat as well for those advanced HCAs, that when you look at sort of documentation for it, it suggests that if they haven't got an MVQ or health and social care diploma, they need at least 2 years of professional development and maturity in the role. And we're seeing people coming through on training who've only been in the post sort of 3 months. And that's really difficult for them. They're still trying to fit into a team, understand the workings of general practice, where they are in terms of their role. And then they're being asked to come forward and take on a lot more than perhaps they should be doing at that point in time.
As you mentioned there about the R's roles coming in, and obviously there's a lot of merging of boundaries and role descriptions. And really it's like pushing the HCA to their full potential, but obviously not overstepping the sort of level of care that they can provide. So with that in mind, can you potentially give a clear definition of the difference of a HCA in regards to someone who is a registered member of staff professional, like a practice nurse or even a trainee nurse associate? You know, where, what's the difference?
Yes, yeah, of course. Well, essentially, both are carers and they both provide care autonomously for the patient. You know, they can be on their own in that room with the patient. Both must be competent, both a nurse and a HCA, and both must be capable in that specific area of care delivery. So if a practice nurse was to join a practice, even as a registered nurse, they would still require training on giving a B12 injection or cytology or baby immunisation. They would still require that to become competent. So competence is across the board, whoever you are, whether you're a registered nurse or a HCA. And in the eyes of the law, both are legally responsible for duty of care and duty of candor. So they do hold that responsibility when they're providing that care. But the main difference is that the nurses have academic qualifications and training to a level that enables them to make clinical judgments. And they apply that critical thinking skills, which basically means they can make a decision about what care should be provided. So the difference is the nurses are both responsible, the same as the HCAs, but they're also accountable for the care that they provide. I guess an example of that, Zoe, would maybe be wound care.
Yep.
So a nurse, for example, a HCA, for example, could provide the wound care, and that is change the dressing, simple wound care, look at the patient, and maybe interpret the risk of that wound. But actually what they can't do then is say, oh yeah, it looks a bit infected. I think I better go and get some antibiotics, or I think I'm going to change the care plan. What they would need to do at that point, when they thought this doesn't look like within my training boundary, this doesn't look like a healthy wound. I've been trained to look and understand what a sign of infection is. But now I think that could be happening. I need to go and get a nurse. The nurse would make the decision about whether that is an infection or not, antibiotics, change the care plan, and the HCA would need to go under that direction. So, yeah, I mean, their job descriptions can look very similar, but the nurses, as I say, hold accountability for the care they provide, and then they delegate that task to the HCA.
So really, we're talking no standalone decisions, really, in terms of clinical judgment and delegated roles to the HCA. Also, can you talk a bit about potentially immunizations and the impact of that being a delegated role to a trained HCA?
Yeah, and again, as I said, everything has to be trained. They're going on a specific training course and they have the competency for that. Things like immunizations come into more level 3 HCA. Mm-hmm. You would expect that HCA to have some understanding around wider healthcare determinants, have done something like an NVQ3 diploma in the past. So that are already coming, as Julia said, with a bit of, you know, maturity, clinical maturity, professional maturity, whatever you want to call it. And so they can speak as well. They have that courage to speak out and ask for help if they need it. So that's the real, you know, key factor of being that level 3, 2 years experience in the practice. If they're doing something a bit more advanced, like immunizations, flu or pneumococcal, and even the vitamin B12, Prostat, those sort of specialist immunizations, what a HCA will do is they'll do a risk assessment. So they'll follow a risk assessment and they'll follow a legal framework called a protocol. And the protocol will be in agreement with the practice and the HCA in accordance with the national minimum standards for immunizations about which patients they can see to give that immunization. Because it won't be everybody. For example, it wouldn't be a child. They can't inject children. They could give their nasal flu to children under indirect supervision. But so there's certain vaccines and things that are just adult only for a start. They follow a protocol and they follow a patient-specific directive, which is another legal framework where the prescriber has effectively assessed the patients who are receiving that medicine. Whereas practice nurses will follow patient group directives, and they will work under their own level of accountability to verify that they've had that training. They will sign the PGD and then they're on their own. But a HCA has very tight legal frameworks. They should have a specific risk assessment list so that if anything on that risk raises a doubt, I'm assessing this patient, let's say, for example, for a shingles vaccine, but I've got my checklist. The checklist, part of my checklist is, are you well today? Have you had a recent episode of shingles? Patient answers yes. HCA is not sure, that throws them off. They can go and get the nurse. This person's just had an episode of shingles. Can I give the vaccine or not? And then the nurse will help them make that decision. So that's the difference. They have the safety of these risk assessments when they're doing that more advanced care. And again, what I said to you earlier, Zoe, is what they can't do is they can't change clinical care. So they can't change care plans. And that means they can't interpret what clinical care might need to happen in action. What I actually mean by that, an example of that, is something like cytology. So if you're a HCA, you're in a practice with a HCA sort of job description, whether you're level two or level three, you won't be able to take a cytology sample, which we used to call a smear test, from a patient. And the reason you can't do that is because it involves examination of the patient and it involves interpretation of health in action. You know, you can't have a risk assessment list to say, look at this and then go and get the nurse. You're there with the patient and you're doing that episode of care. So that requires somebody that's registered to do that assessment and to make that decision. So that wouldn't be something that HCAs do. Does that answer that question?
Yeah, that's fabulous. And I think just going back to, obviously they're working under the direction or indirect supervision of a registered professional. Is it important then to say that they should have somebody around when they're, that they can go to and they've got questions on site?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's key, isn't it? And I know that's, as Julia said in the introduction, it's really hard at the moment because primary care has become busier than ever and people are stretched and they're in, you know, just getting through those patient lists. So we totally understand that. But it's one of the CQC requirements as well as the Care Quality Commission. It's a standard to keep people safe, not just the patient, but the HCAs themselves. They need to be able to access somebody. So once they've been trained, signed as competent, the task is delegated to them. It means they can perform that task on their own in that treatment room or consulting room, but they must be able to physically go and get somebody who is registered to support them should they need at any time, really, during that clinic. So yes, it's strongly advocated that they shouldn't be working in the clinic on their own without a registered practitioner on site. Absolutely.
Perfect. Another thing we're talking about in terms of like their role, if you like, and we know that long-term conditions management is, you know, it's a biggie. So we know that HCAs can have a role to play in long-term conditions monitoring. I just wondered if you might be able to just give a sort of brief overview of what that might look like.
Yes, it leads in nicely from what Julia was just saying, actually, because it's all about the interpretation and the making of the clinical decisions. So the role of the healthcare assistant in managing a long-term condition clinic would be realistically looking at data collection in isolation, but having a protocol to work to, having a risk assessment there so that she knows and can recognise when the data collection that she's obtaining sits outside of normal parameters and when she's going to need to then escalate this to the nurse. It's sort of become a bit of a tiered approach. We hear lots of HCAs are doing particularly diabetic care, and they'll do the full assessment, including taking of the bloods, the heights, the weights, the blood pressures, the lifestyle sort of advice and guidance. But when you start looking then at medications, they'll escalate that then to the nurse, and the nurse specialist will see them perhaps in a follow-up appointment, possibly at the same appointment. They'll come in and see the patient alongside the HCA, or they'll see them afterwards. And then obviously the nurse has her own level of boundary there. She may not be able to then make changes around the medications and she'd have to refer on to the GP. So it becomes a sort of tiered approach. Although interestingly, we're seeing also a lot of pharmacists taking on this role as well. I think within this new R's roles, pharmacists taking responsibilities for things like inhaler use, repeat prescriptions and prescribing around things like COPD and asthma. They're also seeing a lot of the CVD patients for repeat blood pressures and review of medications. So there's again that blurring of boundaries. And I think that can be quite confusing for the patient as well, truthfully. They're not sure when they ring up to make an appointment for an annual review, who am I seeing? Who do I need to be speaking to? And they rely very much on the receptionist putting them into the right place. But then their interpretation might be, well, I'm seeing my GP next month for my review of my diabetes, when in fact it won't be. It might be the healthcare assistant. And acknowledging that appointments are very tricky to get, they come in sometimes a little bit unhappy about that. And the poor old healthcare assistant has to sort of take the brunt of the conversation and say, well, let's make you another appointment. You can come back and see the GP for something else. But there's a very mixed bag of how these clinics are approached, aren't there? So one surgery may still run it with their nurse managing it, but we're seeing more, particularly in the bigger sort of PCN-led type surgeries, that you have a whole team and it will be the HCA starting that assessment, nurse to the next level of medication review, and GP to the next level of those difficult to manage patients, or perhaps the BSN as well involved at that point. Mm.
I think just picking up on what you were saying there, Julia, I think you're right. I think we actually need to increase the public confidence in seeing HCAs for these long-term condition checks. And it's a bit like when you go back in the early 90s when we became nurse prescribers, you know, and patients were coming in to see us. Well, I'm not seeing you for my sore throat. I want to see the GP. And now it's just commonplace. They don't question nurse practitioners at all, do they, around prescribing and seeing them. And actually, some of these HCAs, Zoe, that have come on our diabetes courses, absolutely amazing. And they've gone back and they've said to the nurses, you know, we know about this and we know about that. We know how to do a diabetic foot check and we know what a HbA1c is, a normal blood sugar, and all about hypoglycemia, DVLA. And they've actually gone back with more information than some of the junior practice nurses that Julia said might just be thrown into it because you're a registered nurse, you know, you can get on with it. But actually having a whole day. And our courses, the face-to-face ones we do, we bring in the specialist diabetes nurses as well and go through all the really good health promotion that a HCA can give, you know, about carb counting, about eating well, about looking after yourself, taking ownership, know your numbers, know what your blood pressure is. So we're really encouraging that, Julia, aren't we, in our training, doing the health promotion and making every contact count. And the HCAs are great at that because they have a really good rapport with patients, don't they, around that behaviour change. So I think it's definitely something we need to encourage the public in being more familiar and happy with, seeing the HCAs for their diabetes review, their respiratory, because once they grasp hold of that skill, they run with it. And HCAs, in my experience, are very meticulous. You know, they stick to that guidance, that protocol. So I think it's a safe clinic and it really does help primary care evolve.
The other thing I would suggest as well along that side, that is within the R's roles, you can almost start seeing now the health and wellbeing coaching and the social prescribing and the care coordinator roles fitting into the long-term condition clinics. I mean, we used to talk a long time ago about these joint consultations where you'd have, say, a whole waiting room of patients with diabetes and they come in for their coaching and their health promotion as a group, as rather than an individual. And there's some evidence out there to say that works really well. And if you're trying to get all your patients seen and assessed on an annual basis, what a great way of capturing that information in one hit. And health and wellbeing coaches, I would see that as a fabulous role there, because that's what they're going to be nurtured and trained in providing and sort of getting that information from patients and really establishing what the patient wants from managing their health.
Yeah. And using the team effectively, isn't it, with all their different skills.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like you say, they're quite well placed in their practice, HCAs, to be involved in that long-term conditions sort of management, aren't they? Being that they tend to be the a member of staff that can train to be like a smoke stop practitioner, for example, which again fits into that nicely with the health promotion and everything like that, doesn't it? And we just, you just mentioned there as well, because the HCAs are very meticulous and they build that rapport and they see patients regularly. They are actually build up those trusting relationships with patients. And like you say, it'd be nice to get that confidence from patients in their role, certainly working on that. But I mean, how can practices, do you think how can practices in HCA make sure that they are supported if they're put into what we would say perhaps a challenging situation, being that they can build up these rapports and patients may feel more open to be able to speak to them and offload concerns, issues. What would you say would be how they could safeguard themselves and what they could do in those situations?
Well, I think, you know, a HCA for us is a valuable member of the team, and all, you know, every single person in the team needs the same amount of support. We're all human beings. We've come into a role that is providing care for patients. So that kind of denotes that we're sensitive people ourselves. So, you know, you need our own well-being looked after. So it can be anybody, a nurse, a HCA, you know, a GP, a practice manager. Everybody has stress. Stress it is good and it can become productive. And it's how you manage your stress, isn't it? And so as they're building up these roles, they could actually sometimes take on that level of sort of stress and anxiety from the patient, or and sometimes they just need an outlet. And we call that clinical supervision. And clinical supervision is an opportunity to talk to each other and reflect, think about what just happened to me in that clinic, what conversation I had. And clinical supervision can take all sorts of forms. So, for example, a very busy practice will say, well, you know, we sort of just pass each other in the corridor, said, oh, I just saw a child and I wasn't quite sure if I gave them the right medicine, or whether I prescribed properly, or whether I should have referred them somewhere else. Or, well, grab me at coffee time and we'll go through it and we'll talk about what you did, you know, with that little one when they came in. It's the same for HCAs, except sometimes they need the confidence to know that there is somebody there that can talk to them and go through that clinical supervision support mechanism. It can be, as I said, as informal as a cup of coffee, or actually, if it's something a little bit more in depth, then it needs to be protected time. You know, they need to be able to sit down with their nurse manager or somebody they trust, preferably that's registered. They can actually talk to each other, have peer supervision. But if they're talking to a registered practitioner, it can give them the confidence to say, you know, that's okay. We learn from our mistakes. We admit what's happened. We move on from that. And actually then the outcome will be better for the patient. And also, as you say, Zoe, to develop some strategies for talking to patients in difficult circumstances, whether it be emotional bereavement or whether that patient's frustrated because they can't get an appointment. And one of the things that Julia and I do on our training, we run the HCA Portfolio Clinical Skills course, which is 2 days in the classroom, face-to-face, learning all the skills, such as how to take out stitches. We get a little pad out and, you know, they literally physically remove stitches and diabetic foot check, blood pressure. And then on the third day, we have some time where we look at reflection. And we actually share things like the reflective templates that nurses use at the NMC. So the four P's that we look at around promoting professionalism and trust and practicing effectively. And actually we use those examples of those reflective templates for the HCAs to show them how they could actually document their concerns. Almost it's like a diary form, isn't it? My own son was a HCA. He had a needle stick injury. It didn't go well for him because he was too embarrassed to sort of stop and find out where the protocol was. And so it all had to be dealt with retrospectively. And I asked him to fill out a reflective template about his needle stick injury, how he felt at the time, how he could have, what he could have done differently, and what he'll do in the future. And so we share examples of that with HCAs so they know that actually that could be a useful mechanism for them, just to use reflection and supervision as a way of actually discussing any concerns, worries they have to be able to move on effectively.
That's great. And I guess with the whole supervision thing, it would be in an ideal world if they had like a clinical supervisor or a buddy or somebody that, you know, is there going to. And like you said, clinical supervision if it's a learning thing that they're willing to share, would be quite nice to take to nursing team meetings and have discussions and learning. And
that's right. I mean, you can have it in clinical team meetings. We used to have a supervision element within my prescribing forum where, you know, we were face to face and we were able to go around and talk about areas where we felt underconfident in prescribing or may have made an error and have learned from that. And it was a really useful time. I think the most important thing, and I harp on about it all the time for HGAs, is having their competency signed off. Mm-hmm. You know, a competency is a four-part process around having the knowledge, interpersonal skills and judgment. And you have that competency for everything you do, whether it's a blood pressure or, you know, a diabetic foot check. You will have that knowledge. You've attended a course. The interpersonal is about getting that patient consent. The skills is, you know, if it's a blood pressure, pumping up the cuff, and then the judgment is knowing the parameters. To have that competency signed off, they would need to be assigned a mentor or an assessor. And they're really at the start of their career, whether it's level two or level three, if they're working to these competency frameworks and it becomes part of the course, a normal process for them, then they'll have their mentors and their assessors assigned to them. And then they can be the people they go to for clinical supervision, for any concerns, you know, have their one-to-ones, maybe develop and prepare them for appraisal. And I think that's the relationship we need to start building with our valuable HGA workforce.
Perfect. And presumably as well, job description comes into that as well, doesn't it, as well? So that they, it's in black and white, you know.
Yeah, their job description. Absolutely. Their job description forms part of their contract. So that should be reviewed regularly. If they're being asked to do additional skills such as injectables, their job description should be reviewed, you know, in the level of sort of vicarious liability changes. So all of that needs to reflect the support and assessment they need around that. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you. And I guess just finishing off, is there any tips that either of you have to practices that are looking to employ a HCA for the first time or develop one of their team members, with, like we talked about earlier, Julia, either a receptionist or a phlebotomist that's keen to go on to become a HCA? Any sort of tips how they could best support them and how that would look?
Well, they certainly need support, and I think that's always number one. And the challenge is getting that support in place really before the person enters into the role. It's always challenging to find protected time. It's the same thing that comes up again and again when we're doing teaching, whether it's for healthcare assistants or for nurses. But it doesn't need to be arduous. It doesn't need to be 4 hours out of a day. It can be 30 minutes at the end of a clinic, or, you know, mid-morning, a half hour slot that's blocked off so that they get some quality time together to do exactly what Julia suggested about signing off of competency. You know, we've even joked in the training room, you'll get the healthcare assistant say, "Oh, come on this training around B12. Does the nurse have to watch me do the whole thing, or just when I stick the needle in the arm?" kind of scenario. So they're looking at, that's how they need to get the mentorship. And absolutely not. They need to be with you from the minute you pick that patient into your waiting, from the waiting room into your consulting room, listening to your conversation, watching how you manage the whole cycle of care and manage that consultation, and that the patient leaves the building at the end of it safe and well. It takes time. And I think that's the one critical element that we struggle with in general practice in the whole, not just uniquely to HCAs. But if you invest the time and energy at the early phase, it will give you the reward you are wanting from your HCA. Sadly, HCAs tend to become very despondent and upset and burnt out, whatever word you want to use to describe the role, when they're not supported. And that's the key thing that sometimes is missing, particularly in a smaller practice where perhaps they've only got one nurse or, you know, 1.5 nurses in the week, and there's not that level of support around.
Just to finish off, have you any suggested kind of places, key resources, or anywhere sort of support mechanisms or anything that we could kind of direct practices or HCAs to
Yes, absolutely. And again, I think tips are around grow your own. You know, you'll have a workforce there. There are keen people. There are HCAs that want to do their level three. There are receptionists that want to be HCAs. And listen to what your staff, you know, what their aspirations are. Because if they're really keen and they're motivated and they're passionate about it, you know, some will come and are so interested in mental health. Grow your own workforce, look what's around, try to develop them, because you can do that, and you can do it in a cost-effective way. Loads and loads of resources out there, Zoe. It can be a little bit overwhelming, but, you know, they've got you, they've got the LMC, and they've got us at J2S, and we're always happy to answer emails and questions. I mean, that's really helps to develop us as well. But there's also other e-learning hubs such as Bluestream. And there's a really good one, actually, that I found when you asked us to do this. And I did a bit of research. I looked at the RCN, because we often have HCO saying, is it worth me joining the RCN? Mm. Well, for £4 a month, yes, it is worth you joining. Yeah. For that sort of support that you get as well. But the resources are phenomenal. They're fantastic. They've got one called First Steps, which is an online resource for HCAs. And you don't even have to be joined to do it. It's a free resource. You can have a free account. It's actually got everything from recording orbs right through to safeguarding quality, diversity, infection prevention. So they could work their way through that as well. We know that the care certificate is important, since Mid Staffordshire and Camilla Cavendish really recommended that as that fundamental baseline for HCAs. And again, they can go and do that. They can do that again online through e-learning for health and develop their skills with a care certificate, because that will be a good sort of carrot to come into an appointment to say, I've been looking at the care certificate. I've been looking at these online resources, and this is where I want to develop. So there's lots out there, and they can certainly contact any of us for direction and support as well, because we're really keen to get the HCAs out there in primary care. And as Julia said, develop them safely.
There's a really good framework. There's some excellent frameworks that are sort of embedded, like all of these big government documents. There's often, they've got these hyperlinks within them that take you off into other areas to look at. But I found, from a perhaps management perspective, or if you were looking to employ and you're thinking, what do I want from the person? A great framework for looking at to establish the roles and responsibilities is the primary care and general practice nursing career and core capabilities framework, which is a bit of a tongue twister, long title. But that has got some great resources embedded within it, including job descriptions, so you don't have to reinvent the wheel, including what the expectations are for that role in particular, what the, you know, the job spec is. And actually, it breaks it down even into things like equality and diversity, infection control within that. That's what we would expect of you in this particular domain. So it gives the manager, even if you were non-clinical, I think it's a really easy interpretive piece of legislation there that will help to guide you to who am I going to employ and what is it I want from the individual that we're employing. But I totally agree with Julia, grow your own, because you know your staff better than anyone else. We often get queries come through saying, can my HCA do X, Y, and Z? And we say, well, you know them better than we would know them. We only meet them for a day in a classroom. Are they a reliable witness? Are they somebody who you is trustworthy? Will they work within their scope of competency? If you can answer yes to all of those questions and, you know, they fit into your team well, absolutely, let's grow our own and promote our team.
Perfect. Thank you both so much. And obviously, we'll add all of the resources that you've mentioned there and your contacts if you're both happy. Perfect. Well, we'll leave it there, but thank you so much for joining me today, and thank you, everyone. Bye.
Thank you, Zoe.
Bye. Thanks.
Wessex LMCs, supporting you and your practice.